COVID. I'm tired of talking about it. I'm tired of hearing about it. A word none of us ever heard of a little more than 2 years ago, now probably the most consequential word of a generation. Quite frankly, I'm also sick of mentioning the pandemic in cockpit casual videos, but once again, here we are. I know I sound like a broken record every time I talk about how badly the airline industry was injured by COVID, but it's critical to the story here. 75.6%. That's how much international air travel dropped off year over year between 2019 and 2020. 60% is the number when you include domestic air travel as well, but when you take into consideration China was back up to 100% by the middle of 2020, that helps explain the disparity. With such a rapid and enormous decline in demand, airlines started feeling the financial pain immediately. The cash flow from flying passengers dried up, but the lease payments and maintenance costs were still there. Early lease returns, default, and repossessions quickly became the norm for carriers with too much capacity, i.e., too many idle airplanes. Some airlines put their aircraft into short or long-term storage out in the desert to reduce and stabilize maintenance costs while preserving asset value and long-term readiness for reactivation. Regardless of circumstance, every road forward pretty much meant airplanes being parked, bagged, and taped. The usual boneyards like Victorville and San Bernardino, California, Marana and Goodyear, Arizona, Roswell, New Mexico, Tyrol, Spain, and Tarbes, France filled up quickly. New storage facilities like Alice Springs in Australia sprang up, and relatively new airliners were even parked and stacked at major international airports. Doha, Istanbul, Cairo, at one point even on closed runways and taxiways at Detroit and Atlanta. The point of light in the post-2020 aviation industry has been air cargo. As demand for passenger travel dropped, the demand for air cargo rapidly soared, and virtually every airline in the world got into or expanded their presence in the cargo business. The passenger cabin freighter was born as a hasty solution to utilize space on passenger airliners with the seats out. There are big differences between dedicated freighter aircraft and passenger planes, the largest of which being a main deck cargo door. But as a fast and effective band-aid, 787s, 777s, and even quite a few narrowbodies became de facto freighters, authorized by temporary engineering orders which Boeing and Airbus authorized to help stop the bleeding. LATAM Airlines, the huge multinational multi-AOC conglomerate which dominates South America, had a lot of success with cabin freighters during these times. LATAM also has a dedicated cargo airline. Their fleet presently consists of Boeing 767-300 Boeing Converted Freighters, more commonly known as BCFs, which all previously served LATAM as passenger-configured 767s. During the pandemic, LATAM used a combination of dedicated cargo aircraft and cabin freighters, but quickly prioritized the conversion of their aging, by passenger standards, 767 fleet. They smartly secured cargo conversion slots in Singapore, both at Changi and the Paya Lebar Airbase. We actually dropped off and picked up the first of the SASCO BCFs at Changi, and you're going to get to come along with Cockpit Casual. Over the last few years, we've been a part of several LATAM 767 conversions, but this series will focus on two aircraft in particular. MSN 35697, which is registration CCCXD, and MSN 35696, which is registration CCCXE. Both of these aircraft rolled off the assembly line in Seattle in 2008 and were delivered originally to LAN Chile as Boeing 767-300ER passenger aircraft. Over the first 12 years of their life, these aircraft were utilized heavily on routes between South American cities and the U.S. On occasion, they were also flown to Europe, although LATAM used the A340, 777, and later the 787 and A350 for the longer routes. Both of these missions into conversion originated in Miami, Florida, at LATAM Cargo's main U.S. base of operations. We started our day at the LATAM ops office and printed out our flight paperwork before heading out to the airplane. Because we had a firm conversion slot to make, we couldn't afford to take any rest en route, so we flew with a heavy crew of three pilots and one flight mechanic as to keep the operation rolling. Chris and Tom would fly first, and I slept for the first 7 to 8 hours so that I can take over later and let one of the other guys go into rest. We flew these in the summer and fall of 2021, and we routed the flight with a single fuel stop in Anchorage, Alaska. There we'd turn the aircraft in about 90 minutes and continue down to Singapore. The Great Circle distance from Miami to Singapore is 9,160 nautical miles, almost complete opposite points on the planet. The Anchorage routing is actually the most direct and shortest path, breaking the flight into two segments, an 8.5-hour, 3,500 nautical mile leg Miami-Anchorage, and a 13.5-hour, 5,800 nautical mile leg from Anchorage to Singapore. One thing that was a little different on this one was that we operated the flight on a LAN Chile call sign. We did this only for the first aircraft because for some reason Singapore required it when we filed for the landing slot. We later found a way around this for the next aircraft and operated on the normal nomadic OMD call sign.
LAN Chile, 184 heading, fly heading 0 Lando, runway 9 clip
We'd take off from Miami at just a hair under 300,000 pounds. 412 is the max takeoff weight, so by 767-300 standards, we were quite light. With a pair of GE CF680s under the wings, and at a reasonably light weight, the 76 is a great climber and all-around comfortable, well-rounded, predictable large airplane. I'd say it drives like a Chevy Suburban. CXD was the first of the BCFs to be converted at Changi, and coming out of Miami, it was still configured as a passenger hauler. The cabin was fully intact, and the business class lie-flat seats even still had movies loaded onto the IFE system. I headed back and watched a movie until falling asleep for most of the leg to Anchorage. We left Miami at around 5 p.m., and the sun started setting around 2 hours into the flight. The sun just barely got below the horizon before we made our way northwest at a speed fast enough to make it appear that the sun rose again slightly in the west. Once back up over the horizon, the sun remained in that position all the way to Anchorage. The leg to Anchorage was 8.5 hours long, and we got about a 6-hour long sunset, thanks to the time of year, time of departure, and the unique route. Definitely not something we see every day. Woke up in the last hour of the first leg and gave Chris and Tom a chance to stretch and walk around prior to landing. The everlasting sunset was pretty, but it was also bright, and we dealt with it by stuffing pillows, papers, and sunshades up along the windshield. Thank you.
200. 100. 50. 40. 30. 20. 10.
We landed at 10 p.m. local time, although you wouldn't know it based on the late July sunlight. Evening on the Anchorage cargo ramp, which is where we parked for the fuel stop, is a busy time with dozens of wide-body freighters passing through between Asia and North America. I went outside and did a walk around as the fuel truck hooked up to deliver us just under 20,000 gallons of Jet A. I also took the opportunity to do some plane spotting. There were so many 747s around, we felt tiny in our little 76. The 767-300ER can hold about 24,000 gallons total, so after this top-off, we'd weigh about 343,000 pounds for takeoff. Still about 69,000 pounds under max takeoff weight. The route to Singapore took us out over eastern Russia, Japan, and Taiwan, and there were a ton of waypoints. This aircraft didn't have all the fixes over Asia, so we had to build them with lat-longs. The 767 doesn't make life easy when flying with user fixes. It won't allow us to name them, so care had to be taken to appropriately cross-reference and label each lat-long and shorthand on our flight plan after building each point. This was a two-man operation, and it took nearly 30 minutes. 2.3. CXD was the first of the pair to go into BCF conversion at Sasco in Changi. We flew it as a two-man crew, and the second leg from Anchorage to Singapore was flown completely at night. CXE, on the other hand, was flown as a two-person crew. Chris and I overnighted in Anchorage before departing the following morning. This was because we had a few trips operating at the same time, and only had two available pilots, Chris and I, with valid Chilean license validations. Crews must be licensed in the country that an aircraft is registered in order to operate the flights. These two 767s were on the Chilean registry, hence the CC prefix. So, in order to operate the flights, we had to secure license validations from the DGAC in Chile. A license validation is basically a temporary pilot's license issued by a country's civil aviation authority based on the home license of each pilot. In order to become validated by Chile, we had to submit our FAA credentials and copies of our last proficiency check, along with a small fee. The CAA then processes the application and issues us validations, which are good for a specific aircraft type and valid for 6 months. The flight between Anchorage and Singapore is long, over 15 hours, which is pretty much the limit on an empty 767. We passed the time by taking turns walking around in the back, snacking, reading, listening to podcasts, and watching movies. These LATAM aircraft, unlike most of the other ferry flights we do, have active SATCOM subscriptions with CPDLC, which stands for Controller Pilot Data Link Communications. CPDLC drastically simplifies the long oceanic legs by allowing us to maintain two-way communications with ATC via the aircraft flight management computer. This means position reporting, route and altitude changes, weather deviations and offsets, and handoffs all happen through text communication, manual and automatic in some cases, through the aircraft FMC instead of by voice over HF radios. CPDLC makes an already light workload even lighter, but by regulation, we still need to have the HF radios tuned to the respective frequencies for each FIR and maintain a cell call watch. In the old days, pilots used to carry paper charts in those big rectangular leather bags. Nowadays, all of our charts are contained on iPad applications. This holds true for both regular airline crews as well as us. Not only does it save us from having to lug around heavy binders filled with paper, but it also allows us to get any information we need in a couple of finger swipes. Worldwide data. And it automatically updates and revises every few weeks with a click versus in the past where we'd have to sit there and pull out expired charts and replace them with packs of revisions, which were often 50 to 100 pages deep. You may have noticed sometimes we go against the very concept of cockpit casual by wearing pilot uniforms, at least white pilot shirts with epaulettes. I get a lot of questions on Twitter about this, and the answer is always the same. Some countries have specific rules for arriving crew members with regard to movement around secure areas, dedicated lanes for customs processing on arrival and departure, and special exemptions from COVID restrictions. In most cases, these rules pertain to uniformed crew members, so we must oblige. In other cases, it just helps us move around at the airport without getting strange looks and queries from handling agents. Every time we have to wear uniforms, we either change into plain clothes as soon as the door closes on departure, or change into them before descent and arrival. Singapore is one of those places, so we took turns changing into uniforms before top of descent. Upon arrival into Singapore, we taxied right into Sasco, and the tug crew met us at the gate. We shut down on the taxiway so they could bring us into the tight ramp space under tow. We filled out the ship logbook, wrote down the discrepancies, and boarded a van which would drive us to the terminal after clearing a security checkpoint at the facility's gate.
All right, man. Just a few hours and we'll be heading back
via Qatar.
Well, not really a few hours, yeah.
Several hours. 11 hours.
10 hours. Nice. I'm so caffeinated right now. I don't know how I'm going to sleep here.
I was dying to drink a cup of coffee and right away.
Yeah, I've been wired this whole flight for some reason. I'm not sure exactly why.
Ava says you have to call ADHD.
Yeah.
I think that's accurate.
There's the next one we're taking out back in there.
Both CXD and CXE arrived Changi during COVID lockdown, so the measures were tight. As crew, we were provided with a special entry letter that allowed us to utilize the quarantine hotel at the airport. The Inn Terminal Crowne Plaza in Singapore is actually a really nice modern hotel, and compared with other quarantine facilities around the world, it's among the best. We were not allowed to leave our rooms until departure time, so we ordered some room service and took naps before completing the circumnavigation, this time as passengers on Qatar Airways via Doha. As I always say, the Qatar Airways Q Suite is the best business class product on the market, and I always personally opt for Qatar as a means of travel when possible. The 26 hours it took to get home passed by in an instant because I slept through nearly all of it. Said and done, both round-the-world ferries into Singapore would only take 4 days and with very little downtime. A few weeks after delivering CXE to Sasco, Ava and I would return to pick up CXD, which will be the focus of Part 2 next week.